from KQED.
Support for the California Report comes from the Wesley Foundation, recognizing young social entrepreneurs through the Wesley Prize for Young Innovators of California. Digital Foundry, working with leading organizations to jumpstart digital innovation. More online at digitalfoundry.com. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org.
On today's California Report magazine, we hear from an 11-year-old who's registering people to vote, and from some of the Californians who plan to vote for Donald Trump.
I keep it a secret because being brown and being openly gay and voting for Trump is not the thing.
Plus, the 25th anniversary of a devastating fire in Oakland that burned 3,000 homes. And we talk with Gustavo Dudamel, the conductor of the LA Philharmonic, about why music is so critical in times of conflict.
In these moments that people are trying to create more borders between us, between human beings, we have to try to build more bridges.
I'm Sasha Coca, and this is the California Report magazine. Believe it or not, we're only a couple weeks away from the election. We're going to start our show today in the Central Valley, where, unlike in most of California, voters are pretty evenly split over Trump and Clinton. That's according to the latest field poll. The Valley is one of the redder places in our mostly blue state, with the most controversial candidate in memory at the top of the GOP ticket. Our Central Valley Bureau Chief, Vanessa Rancagno, talked to some Republican voters about how they're feeling.
I figured I should start with agriculture. It's the biggest industry here, and farmers tend to lean Republican. I ended up in William Bordeaux's truck, driving down a gravel road in Coalinga, surrounded by bare fields.
These fields have produced many, many crops over many years. Watermelons, lettuce, broccoli, but they're all fallow now.
Bordeaux is vice president of Harris Farms, one of the largest agricultural outfits in the state. Back in his office, Bordeaux tells me his biggest concern this election is water. Like most farmers around here, he says he needs more of it, and going without has a toll.
It's very difficult for people that are hardworking. They want to work, but if you can't provide a job because you don't have the water, there's nothing you can do.
He blames state and federal regulators for prioritizing the environment over agriculture, and he's made up his mind about which presidential candidate will change that.
Where did you guys take this picture?
I think it was one of the fundraisers or the rally.
On the wall, he's got a photo of himself smiling next to Donald Trump. He's got quite a few Trump signs, too.
I've met with Trump 3 different times. We had a very frank conversation. He was able to incorporate what we talked about into his speech that he delivered to thousands of people. He's very impressive.
Wow, thank you, everybody. What a crowd. What a crowd.
We have a water problem that is so insane. It is so ridiculous. If I win, believe me, we're going to start opening up the water so that you can have your farmers survive.
That was Trump at a rally in Fresno. He's been to the Valley twice in the past few months and broken fundraising records. Clinton hasn't been here since before the primary. The next place I went looking for people to talk to was the big Fresno Fair. I found Democrats and Republicans, including one who wasn't keen on Trump. Anthony Hill says it disturbs him that Trump has no political experience.
I mean, I'm conservative, but it's Donald Trump. Like, he needs to go back to Celebrity Apprentice.
I also met Steven. He asked me not to use his last name, but told me he grew up in a small town here in the Valley, and he was raised Republican.
I may be Hispanic, but I'm American. The U.S. flag is my flag. The Mexican flag is not my flag. And that's just how I see things.
Steven says that's why he's not bothered by Trump's comments about Mexican rapists and his hardline stance on immigration. Steven's not exactly advertising his support for Trump, though.
I keep it a secret because being from the Valley, being brown and being openly gay and voting for Trump is not the thing.
Yeah, it's not.
I told him I would think a rural Central Valley town would be a fairly conservative place. So he explained.
Because in the Valley, it's mainly Latino. That's what it is.
The Central Valley does have a big Latino population, and it's growing. And Latinos overwhelmingly vote Democratic. But when I went to a naturalization ceremony in Fresno, I met a Mexican immigrant who also supports Trump.
We are so honored to welcome you as American citizens.
Two, three. Cheese, cheese, and cheese again.
Outside, Israel Cervantes was posing for pictures with his framed citizenship certificate. He's an industrial mechanic who's been in the U.S. 25 years. Now he finally feels like he has a voice in the political process.
I feel like I'm fighting for what I want.
And that's Trump.
I want security. I want safety. I want peace. I want a strong leadership.
Also, Cervantes doesn't believe in abortion, and he doesn't want to see a Democrat choose the next Supreme Court justice. But Cervantes' 19-year-old son raised some doubts.
He's kind of impulsive, you know, he's quick to anger.
Yeah, but he was not a political guy. He's a Hollywood guy, you know, like Ronald Reagan was a Hollywood guy.
Cervantes said he wasn't troubled by allegations that Trump had mistreated women. He and other Central Valley Republicans feel their candidate is getting a bad rap. And they care more about the issues anyway. For the California Report, I'm Vanessa Rancagno in Fresno.
That's the Youth Orchestra Los Angeles, a music education program connected to the LA Philharmonic. It gives instruments and training to hundreds of kids from underserved communities in LA. It's the brainchild of Gustavo Dudamel, who made his debut conducting the LA Phil when he was just 24 years old. Now, the Youth Orchestra is celebrating its 10th anniversary with its first tour across California next week, with concerts in Southern California, the Central Valley, and the Bay Area. The orchestra is just one of the ways the LA Phil has expanded its reach into the community under Dudamel's leadership. And he joins us now on the California Report magazine. Welcome to our show, maestro. Is that the right thing to call you?
Well, yes, but I prefer that you call me Gustavo.
All right, then.
But pleasure to be with you.
Thank you. Gustavo, tell me about some of the kids in the Youth Orchestra Los Angeles. What is this first ever California tour mean for them?
This is a program inspired by El Sistema, a program that we have in Venezuela. And let's say that I'm a result of this beautiful musical, artistic, social program. And yes, you know, for 10 years we have developed many things, especially, you know, the personality of these children, you know, their belief in life. And this is the beautiful thing that music gives to them. And we are very happy that we are doing our first tour after 10 years. It's a good way to celebrate.
As you say, you got your start with El Sistema, which is the government-sponsored music education program in Venezuela.
Yes.
And
yeah.
You still direct an orchestra in Venezuela, but yep. You've shied away a little bit from weighing in on the current political crisis there until
yes.
Recently when you made some comments at a White House ceremony. Tell us what you said.
Well, you know, normally in times of crisis, the first thing that people cut is art. And art, music, the cultural things for the children. And the people don't understand that art is a very important element of human beings, you know. It's beauty, it's creativity. In my country, it's a very difficult economic, political time. And I think El Sistema is a symbol of this hope of the country.
Your comments generated a lot of criticism from people on Twitter and on the internet, you know, people who were thinking that you were being too insensitive to the fact that many people in Venezuela are having trouble getting food, you know, meeting their basic needs.
But absolutely. And you know, I have family living there. They are suffering the same things. But the thing is that you have to keep working. I'm a person that work. I don't like to talk. I'm not a politician, my dear. I'm a musician, I'm an artist, of course I'm a citizen, but what I do is what I can do to spread the message of music and art as a very important element of humanity. And I'm with my country, I'm with all the people that are suffering all of this, but what I can say is that we will get out of this difficult moment, but keep working and keep dreaming. because nobody can kill our dreams.
I gotta ask you about Mozart in the Jungle, the Netflix show about a young Latin American conductor. It was loosely based on your story, although the character in that show has kind of a hot temper and he's a kind of a womanizer.
I'm not that. Yes, it's inspired by, you know, my beginning as a musician arriving here to Los Angeles, but the character, we are completely different. Yes, of course, we are very inspired about what we do, but I'm not as crazy as Rodrigo.
Please join me in welcoming a man who need only be introduced by his first name, your new conductor and musical director, Rodrigo.
I have fun watching the TV series because it's really great. It's good. It's a good way to get people, you know, connected to classical music.
You recently got to conduct part of John Williams' soundtrack for the latest Star Wars movie, The Force Awakens. What was that like?
Well, amazing. Imagine knowing this film and this music since I was a child. And I'm so thankful, grateful of life, you know, to have John Williams as a friend. And when he called me, I was like, are you sure, John? You are not joking? This is true? Yes, no. I would love to give a surprise to the orchestra. And then it was a great experience. So,
well, does Los Angeles feel like home for you now?
Yes, completely. I feel so beautiful. And I try to make every day more connections between, you know, my country and Los Angeles and building projects, education projects. Because in these moments that people are trying to create more borders between us, between human beings, we have to try to build more bridges. Of course, we cannot be agreeing in everything, but from the disagreement, we can build things, beautiful things. Hmm.
Gustavo Dudamel of the LA Philharmonic, thank you so much
pleasure.
For joining
thank
us.
Thank you, Sasha. Big pleasure. Thank you very much.
And now we head to the hills of Oakland and Berkeley, where 25 years ago this week, just as the Bay Area was recovering from the Loma Prieta earthquake, a new disaster struck.
For homeowners, it was a living hell. The fire engulfed canyons and ridges, jumped roads, and swallowed up the entire neighborhood.
The East Bay Hills Fire still ranks as one of the most damaging fires in California history. It eventually killed 25 people and burned 3,000 homes. In this next story, KQED's Danielle Venton talks to people who were there and who are trying to make sure a fire like that never burns again.
I'm at the end of Temescal Canyon in Berkeley, and I'm pretty sure I'm at the exact spot where the East Bay Hills fire started 25 years ago. It was here in this affluent residential neighborhood that a fire started in someone's backyard around noon on an October Saturday in 1991. Fire crews put it out less than an hour and a half after it had been reported, but there were some hot spots that lingered. And on Sunday morning, October 20th, a hot, dry wind started coming over the hills from the east, blowing west towards the bay, and the fire broke out again.
Surrounded by fire, smoke, and cannon.
So the fire came down from up here then?
The fire came was coming down, yeah.
That morning, Margaret Schaefer was going for a walk in the hills with her brother-in-law.
And we walk, and we do see the smoke in the background. And pretty soon I say, Ray, this is not looking very good. And then suddenly we saw people running.
A flare-up that crews had started fighting around 11 a.m. was completely out of control by 11:30.
I actually didn't think the house was going to burn down. I thought, well, it won't come this far, or, you know, we should still evacuate.
She showed me the site of her old house.
And that's a lot. It's the one thing that's not been rebuilt.
Schaefer and her family were able to rebuy in the area. Others started rebuilding within a few years. The city of Oakland encouraged the growth and imposed new fire safety standards. Schaefer knows another fire is a possibility, but...
Yeah, why am I not more scared of fire? Interesting, I'm not.
The fire that destroyed her home and 3,000 others was as hot as 2,000 degrees because of the seasonal winds that literally fanned the flames.
My name is Carrie Bowers. I'm studying fire weather, specifically the Diablo winds of the San Francisco Bay Area.
Bowers is a graduate student at the Fire Weather Research Laboratory at San Jose State. Bowers' goal is to develop a way to warn fire authorities when the winds are about to get really dangerous. Through her study, Bowers has been able to pinpoint the movements of those Diablo winds 25 years ago, nearly down to the hour.
Around the start of the increased intensity of the fire, 10-11 a.m. was when we saw a really large decrease in relative humidity.
Winds came down from the Central Valley, warming and accelerating, and rapidly drying the already parched East Bay Hills when they hit. So every October, residents like John Kaufman, who lived through the fire, are especially watchful.
You see, all these houses down here are new.
Kaufman is part of the Claremont Canyon Conservancy, a nonprofit that works to improve fire safety in the area. Driving through the neighborhood, Kaufman points out the giant eucalyptus, which are common in the area.
They're very oily trees, and once the crowns catch fire in the Diablo winds, the fire can spread.
Kaufman says he's relieved when the rains come this time of year. He shows me a memorial garden built by some neighbors.
It's a memorial to those who lost their lives, and it's also an exhibit about what you can do to minimize fire problems from occurring in the future.
Planted all around the replica of a burned-out house is a garden full of California native fire-resistant plants. For the California Report, I'm Danielle Venton in Oakland.
And now, from fire to epic drought. For this next story, we head back to the Central Valley, to the tiny farm worker town of Poplar, where the droughts had a devastating impact on the wells that provide drinking water. But here's an unexpected silver lining. Those water woes are getting people to register to vote. Ruben Tapia of Radio Bilingüe, the National Latino Public Radio Network, introduces us to a very young activist behind that effort.
Meet Isaiah Rocha Morales. He is 11 years old, a sixth grader at Pleasant View Elementary School in Poplar.
Everything is boring here. There's not a lot to do. Almost no one goes to the park.
His teacher described his behavior as difficult, sometimes challenging.
He displayed some pretty disruptive behaviors in class at times. He just wasn't on task.
But Isaiah is getting more focused these days. He joined a group of activists who are knocking on doors to register new voters. I meet up with them at a Mexican restaurant.
So your dad needs to sign us whenever he gets back.
In the first political campaign of Isaiah's life, he's already managed to register his parents and three other people.
A lot of people want to register and vote. They want to change what's happening here.
Poplar is home to 2,500 people, mostly Latinos. But in the June primary, fewer than 100 voters cast ballots. Activists like Isaiah hope to double that by registering more than 100 new voters. They are hoping enthusiasm about one item on the ballot will help: the race for two open seats on the board of the local community service district. Poplar doesn't have a mayor or city council. The only local elected officials are the five members of the board that manage water and sewer. Gary Maynard is the vice president.
All we govern is water and sewer.
Drinking water is a problem here. The town has three wells, but one is highly contaminated with nitrates, which have been linked to cancer. And the water levels on the other two wells have been steadily falling with the drought. Arturo Rodriguez is a 31-year-old native of Poplar. He and his brother are among the four candidates who want to fill the two vacancies on the board.
From what I know, it's the first time this board has been on the ballot.
It's been a long time since we had an election.
Gary Maynard says the problem is Poplar residents lack interest in local affairs.
What it is that we had a problem getting members to join the board.
But residents I talked to say they don't remember receiving information about any open seats on the board or the activities of the water board in general. 2 months ago, dates for upcoming meetings did start to appear on water bills, but only in English, in a town that is mostly Spanish-speaking. I head to the tiny water board office to find out why.
That's pertaining to the county.
Connie Mendiola is the secretary. She chose me a water bill with the date for the next meeting.
Board meeting, September the 1st. So this is on everybody's bill. Everybody receives a bill here so that they can see what's going on.
In English.
In English. I didn't know that we had to go bilingual.
We don't have to go bilingual.
This kind of insensitivity to the Latino community is one of the reasons 11-year-old Isaiah is motivated to register his neighbors.
We Latinos, our parents go to the field and they work like donkeys, and some die in the heat.
Isaiah says he hopes by the time he gets to vote, Poplar will have a better future, one in which there's room at the decision-making table for everyone. For the California Report, I am Ruben Tapia in Poplar.
Politics are on a lot of people's minds lately, and it's been a little tense, but we've also got to have some fun. So it's time to close out our show with some music. The California Report's Susie Racho and our jazz critic Andrew Gilbert join us every month to talk about the latest from jazz musicians here in the Golden State. Today, two new releases, one that reinvents the breakup album, and another that combines the Beatles with gypsy jazz.
That's Tim Conley. He's a producer and multi-instrumentalist, also known as Mast, and that's from his new album, Love and War. And for a sophomore album, he's making a statement, I think.
Yeah, I think this is one of those situations where he got out of a not-so-great two-year relationship and is looking to, you know, gain something from the experience. And he created the album in sort of three acts, the sort of initial infatuation, the blow up, and then rising above. And it all flows together really interestingly. It's a complete story.
And the record's really diverse. You know, at times when I was listening to it, it was like, wow, this is a little bit more electronica than actual, like, you know, straight up jazz. But it's not just instrumentals, right?
No, there are quite a few instrumentals, but he has a lot of guests on it. There's themes that keep reappearing from track to track. They sort of go away and come back. And in a lot of ways, I feel like he's setting up some of these fantastic guest artists he has. The saxophonist Gavin Templeton, Taylor McFerrin, the R&B singer Riot, who has a really interesting track.
That's The Breakup by Mast. That's from the new record Love and War. And he comes from a background of improvisational jazz back in Philly. But does his work offer any hints at that background at all?
It does, but just hints, Susie. I mean, he plays with this fantastic group, Fresh Cut Orchestra, but this album was really inspired by his experience at Low End Theory. This weekly club night sort of attracts some of the most creative DJs, and you could hear him sort of lifting ideas left and right in terms of texture and grooves and just sort of sound sculpting. It's this, a lot of what's been going on in the LA scene, this cross-pollinization.
The Flying Lotus and all those.
Exactly,
groups.
Brain Feeder and, you know, the scene around Kendrick Lamar where you have people with a jazz background but taking it in all kinds of interesting directions.
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite tracks on this features the rapper, the Koreatown Oddity, and it's called Should Have Swiped Left.
Bottle, gotta tell him how you really feel, like he impaled at Obama. You know that one skit we watched where he's like, I feel like this, and he's like, no, President,
no
you
matter
feel like
the status
on what the options is, it's all about building back up your confidence. So once it returns to that level, don't let it come back down for no shit, because they can make you feel like an unwanted 12 inch on a shelf that sits like John Denver's greatest hits.
That's Mast, and I love the title of that song. It's called Should Have Swiped Left. And while Mast is reinventing the breakup album, the next record we're going to talk about, The Hot Club of San Francisco, combines the Beatles and Gypsy Jazz on John, Paul, George, and Django.
That's right. The Hot Club of San Francisco has sort of been the flagship Gypsy Jazz ensemble, really, in the West Coast for more than 20 years. They really sparked sort of the Gypsy Jazz revival in a lot of ways. And it's led by guitarist Paul Melling, who has been a Beatlephile since he was a tyke. And so in a lot of ways, he's been building up to this album.
That's the Hot Club of San Francisco. They've had a long career playing songs that are inspired by even Django Reinhardt. But we've heard albums like this before, you know, where people from different genres, rock and folk and stuff, all cover the Beatles. But why does this work for you?
I think I love the acoustic treatment. You know, a lot of different players have cycled through the Hot Club over the years. This is a really strong lineup. Violinist Evan Price is just a fantastic player. And you can hear the way he interacts with rhythm guitarist and vocalist Isabel Fontaine, say, on For No One. And it's the kind of thing you've got to be really strong players to do this.
And in her eyes.
That's For No One by the Hot Club of San Francisco, doing the Beatles there. Their new record is called John, Paul, George, and Django. And Andy has more on the releases from the Hot Club of San Francisco and Mast at californiareport.org. Thanks so much, Andy.
Thank you, Susie.
Andrew Gilbert is the California Report's jazz and world music critic.
You think she needs you.
And that's the California Report magazine, a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. Our director is Susie Racho. Our technical producer is Seal Muller. And we had additional engineering from Howard Gelman. David Marks is our online producer. Our interns are Lacey Jane Roberts and Eli Wertschafter. The California Report's senior editor is Victoria Maulione. And our editorial staff includes Pat Flynn, Tyke Hendricks, Ingrid Becker, Ethan Lindsay, and Holly Kernan. I'm Sasha Coca. Thanks for listening. This is the California Report magazine.
Support for the California Report comes from the California Endowment, working to achieve health and justice for all. Learn more at calendow.org. The James Irvine Foundation, expanding economic and political opportunity for Californians who are working but struggling with poverty. More at irvine.org. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org.